Friday edition rolling into the happier happy hour. And I'm happy to announce we've been joined by former U.S. attorney, our good friend, James Santel. Jim, how you doing, man?
Don, Mike, good to be with you once again on this beautiful sunny day in Wisconsin and in the United States of America.
Thank you, Jim.
We're still a republic, right, Jim?
We are. As far as I checked just before we went on the air, I think it's still intact. We may be teetering, but we'll try to remedy that in the next 45 minutes, right?
We will do our best to solve all the world's problems. Jim, here's one of my problems. My grievance for this Friday, if you will. Pat Cipollone giving testimony today, and I don't know what he said, Jim. When am I going to find out? Do you think the J6 committee's already got, you know, a video team working on right. the testimony to roll out for the public on Tuesday, or will they save it for the prime time next Thursday
night? The AV club is all over it, Jim.
Either one of those, depending upon what the subject matter may be, but I think you're right. If you're in the IT team of the J6 committee, don't anticipate spending a lot of time with your family this coming weekend. So lots of work to do. Pat Cipollone, as you indicated, spent eight hours of time today with the committee. And what that tells me is that he is talking. And that may sound self-evident, but the reality is that if he had gone in there and raised executive privilege, pleaded the fifth, other things like that, this would have been much quicker. He is talking. He's providing detail. And you join that with the notion that this is a man who was right there. If my recollection of the West Wing geography is correct, the counsel's office is right below down a staircase from the central offices where the Oval Office where the president is. He was right there for an awful lot of this on January 6th, before and afterwards. There's a lot of material to cover here. And so I think that, again, the J6 committee is going to be mining a lot of this next few days for presentation next Tuesday and again prime time.
But I want to know now. I feel like Veruca Salt. Jim, there's other reporting at the Washington Post. It's on the front page right now. Trump considers waiving claim to executive privilege for Steve Bannon to testify before the January 6th House committee. And, sir, I haven't read the details of the story. I know that you have not either. But this is the most befuddling headline I have seen recently. A, why would Trump have a say? Joe Biden's the chief executive. B, Bannon didn't work at the White House at the time in question. And C, the guy's already been charged with criminal contempt. Hell, his trial starts, or at least is scheduled to start, on July 18th.
Yes, yes, and yes. How many things can we unpack there that are problematic? The headline, obviously, the writers attempted to capture some of the latest craziness from our former president and may not have done a complete job. You're absolutely right. Once again, executive privilege to be claimed by the present president. We know that from previous cases in which documents and testimony have been an issue. We know, too, that executive privilege is not one of those things that is a broad doctrine out there. And among other things we have talked about, if you are talking about criminal behavior, if you're talking about doing something like, say, overthrowing the government or undermining the normal processes of it, that's a crime in most books. And there is something called a crime fraud exception to all these privileges, including attorney-client privilege. Those things also apply. And if that sounds too legal for you, and it doesn't. The reality is that this is just another attempt by the former president to be heard at a time when plainly he is, I think, probably feeling some heat here. His former counsel is now going in to talk, and others are coming forward. We've got issues in Georgia happening, and I think he needs to send messages to America that this is all crazy, when in fact it is not.
Jim, do you agree with me, counselor, the only logical choice at this point for Donald Trump is to declare he's running for president again?
You know, there are an awful lot of people who say that would be the mechanism, right? Because then you will maintain that if, whether it's Fannie Willis or Merrick Garland or someone else indicts you that is political and try to stop your political campaign, that may well be. That's the doctrine that's out there politically. It certainly is not a legal doctrine. And again, in context of prosecutions by the U.S. Department of Justice, so I've often said you go where the law and the facts lead you. And you do that with some freedom, some discretion. You've got to exercise judgment well. But you do that until it would really affect an election. And typically, although it's unwritten, That's somewhere between 40, 50, 60 days out. If Merrick Garland has enough to indict a former president, as I've said so many times with you and with Dom on this show, the decision not to charge, not to indict because of political reasons is as corrupt as the decision to indict because of your political enemies or other political animations. And so he's got to do what's right. This attempt to indicate that I'm going to be running for president by the former president here, that's, again, just a latest attempt by Donald Trump, I think, to avoid that and to be able to come up with another defense down the road, which is not meritorious.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of ours, joining us. Jim, appreciate it. As always, happy Friday. Fawnie Willis, Fulton County, D.A., Georgia. You brought it up. Let's go there for a moment. She issued a bunch of new subpoenas, including to a sitting senator who's, on the Judiciary Committee, Lindsey Graham, who's going to fight it, Jim. And he's a lawyer, to my understanding, as well. Jim, what's your take on that particular part of this?
Sure. Again, as we've talked before, what does fight mean? Well, if you are saying you're not going to show up, that's a real problem. We know that that's pure contempt. You need to show up at a minimum and raise a privilege. The question is, what kind of a privilege does he have? Well, he's got a right to declare his shielding under the Fifth Amendment if, in fact, he engaged in some crimes, which could, in fact, be the situation. Executive privilege, probably not. And so, again, this is a political response to a governmental purpose and a governmental function. The other thing I see from this Fulton County matter is very impressive also that, as you indicated, Dom, subpoenaing as many as 50 people. This indicates that she is looking beyond just this singular phone call to the former Secretary of State there, Brad Raffensperger, asking for the 11,780 votes. She is looking for a larger conspiracy. She's trying to figure out if there is more of a, as some people have said, sort of a RICO case here involving lots of people. You could charge that very discreet prosecution unit just the call and the attempt to undermine the election. She is looking broader than that, and that's why the Rudy Giuliani's and the John Eastmans, and maybe even some as senator, might be implicated by what she is doing. A very interesting revelation about how broadly she is interpreting what happened there in violation of Georgia law, not federal law.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I mean, we got the tape. I mean, you could have charged him immediately. You know what I'm saying? So the fact that there's all this time and effort and energy and subpoenas going into this, it certainly seems to indicate a wider investigation, as you mentioned. But, you know, what is a RICO, how does that impact, how would that change this particular Fulton County in Georgia? How would that change this investigation if it becomes a RICO act or a RICO investigation?
It doesn't. I've prosecuted and presented the grand jury RICO indictments. It is just a lawyer's way of saying, you know, there's a very sophisticated criminal enterprise here that had tendrils, it had purpose, it had definition. This wasn't just a random operation. It's very organized and structured, and that's what she's plainly focusing on. And again, thinking about what may have happened here, as we're thinking about the White House and the January 6th committee here, she is looking to see whether or not, with respect to Georgia in particular, were the things said by Senator Graham, were the things said by these others, Rudy Giuliani, that affected in a very structural way the way that they attempted to undermine the Georgia vote. And again, it may just be a label for some people. My sense of it just more accurately represents how broadly she's looking at this and the number of people who could be brought into the ambit of a possible grand jury indictment coming out of Georgia. Again, the narrow event was the one we all think about, but she is plainly looking for lots of different tendrils here and would not be surprised, however you call it, a conspiracy, a RICO violation, allegation, it is broad.
Racketeering, Influenced, and Corrupt Organizations Act, that seems to apply in this case. Willis implied or said that she would possibly send a subpoena to the former president himself. Could, if that were to happen, could Trump just drag this thing out, you know, for years, Jim?
Once again, as we have seen, the answer is yes and no. Again, at a minimum, you would think that you'd have to show up, right? That's right. The basic understanding that people like Steve Bannon and others have come to understand, or will hopefully come to understand fairly shortly. Would he run back into court? Sure. Of course he will, and there will be those lawyers who will be happy to take on that case, that cause. Is it a successful one? No, because once again, she will not say that we're asking to trample over his Fifth Amendment rights or his other privileges that he can legitimately raise. She is asking for information. And the extent that he wants to raise those privileges and those defenses, that's okay. But he's got to identify then the basis for doing that. Courts look at that all the time and figure out whether or not that's genuine or not. That is what takes time. Undeniably, the former president would go down that route.
James Santel, our fine guest, you're listening to The Devil's Advocate. Jim, 1 week from today, Trump's already scheduled to what? Be deposed under oath. Now, that's a civil matter, Jim, but anytime Trump is under oath, I see it as a good day. How about you, sir?
Right. And the other thing to keep in mind, again, the civil proceeding is that while you can raise the Fifth Amendment and certainly other privileges, you know, it doesn't have all of the trappings of a criminal process. Obviously, in the criminal proceeding, a prosecutor could never call, never compel testimony in the first instance. Here you've got a civil piece of litigation. The other recollection and strong thing that all lawyers who practice in the civil area that understand is the civil case. Especially in a deposition, you don't have to narrowly circumscribe what your focus is. I can ask things that may lead to other things, even if I don't know where they may go. So the questions can be relatively broad. They've got to be relevant material, but they can ask a lot of things that may not be focused just upon the narrow subject matter of the lawsuit itself.
And if he pleads the fifth in a civil case, Jim, in the last 30 seconds of the segment, that can be used against him, right?
Absolutely. You assume that the negative inference that what they're asking you about would be the truth, and that can be used in a civil proceeding against you. Absolutely. It carries with it that significant consequence.
Folks, take the long way home. We got a fine guest, James Santel, former U.S. attorney. Come back with us.
Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday to you.
Birthday parties. Getting back to the moments we miss starts with getting informed.
What'd you wish for? No, don't tell them, Grandpa. That's not true.
Get the latest info about COVID-19 vaccines at getvaccineanswers.org. It's up to you. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Devil's Advocates. Sausage making never looked so good.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. Some say the greatest radio show ever. Make sure you check us out on the socials, on Facebook at the Devil's Advocates Radio, on Twitter at Devil Radio. And if you miss any of this fine show, check out the podcast at darnwi.com.
Dom, that's the great thing about radio, repetition. You say it enough, people start believing it. We do have the finest of guests. He is James Santel, former U.S. attorney, our good friend. Jim, always appreciate you coming around. And I believe you're coming in from the bullpen on Tuesday and filling in for the boys.
That is correct. I'll be talking about January 6th, no doubt, that afternoon.
Well, the January 6th hearings, the live hearings and the gavel-to-gavel coverage on Devil Radio and the Shaw, they renew on Tuesday. We're going to play them live, and then, Jim, you get to come and knock them down, man. I hope it's good stuff. Jim, here's something I've noted separate of the January 6th committee activities. And I've actually taken a lot of heart from this. Jeffrey Clark was effectively searched, right? Jeffrey Clark. He was the Department of Justice official, the guy that was going to move up the food chain rapidly if Trump had his way. And so was Eastman. And I sometimes, you know, forget there are so many multiple coup plots happening at the same time. I sometimes, confuse those two malfeasant attorneys. But Eastman has also been searched by the Department of Justice, I believe, Jim. Well, that's pretty significant. I mean, these are pretty high up. Clark was in the Department of Justice. Eastman also, right, part of the Department of Justice.
Right. And authoring memorandums, Eastman was, about how to make this all happen. I mean, his is the fountainhead from which all this springs. He puts together this design. We've got a judge in California who looks at all those emails, looks at the Eastman products and says, yes, President of the United States of America, the former president, committed crimes. a lot going on here. And again, to underscore what we have chatted about at great length, your listeners know this well, in order for the federal government to get a warrant to search, this isn't just some random decision by agents some morning waking up and saying, gosh, I wonder what John Eastman may have in his home, or I wonder what Jeffrey Clark may have in his home, stunning a former Department of Justice high-level supervisor, superior there, having his home searched, his records taken. What that means is that a federal judge looked at the evidence presented by an assistant U.S. attorney, others from the FBI, other places within the government, and said, you know what? There is probable cause to believe that if you go into those places that are owned and operated by the Eastmans and by the Clarks of the world, you will find what? Evidence of a criminal offense, evidence of a crime. That's as clear as you can state it right now. We don't know. It's certainly not evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. We're not convicting anybody of that. But there has to be that judicial finding as a predicate to go in the first place, which means that again, it'll be fascinating one day to get a hold of those affidavits that are put together in support of the search warrants, because they would lay out an awful lot. You'd have to stay on the radio 24 hours a day to get through all the material that I suspect are in the Eastman and the Clark affidavits alone to support that law enforcement activity that did just take place. And right now, of course, what's happening is those agents have got all that material. What are they doing? Just like the IT people at the J6 committee, they're spending all their time pouring through all those documents, electronic and otherwise, trying to figure out what they've got and what that criminality looks like based upon the materials that they have seized. It's a huge undertaking, but it's also very significant in the course of this investigation.
Jim, I'm going to confess on behalf of the panel, it's the last Friday night of Summerfest. Dom's not doing the homework. Our fine guest, James Santel, he is a former U.S. attorney, currently a fine host right here on the Shaw. Get up Saturday mornings, 9 to 11, morning cannolis with Jim Santel. And Jim, you should have plenty to talk about. And I haven't seen it confirmed, but I understand, are they doing a prime time next week, Thursday? Is that what we understand? Have they scheduled?
Right. That's what I'd heard also just before we got on the air right now. Just checked on that. And it appears that Benny Thompson and Liz Cheney and Adam and all the Adams and so forth on the committee are confirming just that. So if this is in some way, it's not the end, plainly, but if it's the bookend of what we saw a couple of weeks ago, this could be very, very significant again, probably bringing together a lot of the tendrils, a lot of those pieces out there and summarizing them for a primetime audience. We know that even some of the daytime audiences are high visibility programs, and they're getting a lot of viewers. That could be, again, at the same level as what we saw a couple of weeks ago.
And Jim, you know, we've talked about this all the way back to the missed opportunity that was the Mueller public hearings, effectively. And of course, the incongruence of the Jim Jordans of the world jumping in, you know, people just basically throwing random allegations, taking the conversation in so many different directions. And these hearings have not been, they've not been filled with propaganda and misdirection, Jim. They've stayed very much on track. So I ask you, sir, do you think they're moving the needle?
I do. I think that, again, not just because of polling out there and the ratings, if you will, from television, but in my very limited, very anecdotal sense of talking with people who do not have time to watch all this. They are watching summaries of it. They're watching the evening programs. They're reading the headlines, and they're also reading the text that follows those headlines. And I think they are getting a much better sense now, certainly than the Mueller testimony did a couple of years ago, of what happened before, during, and after January 6th. I do think it's moving the needle. It doesn't have to do anything in terms of the Department of Justice. We know that we know with clarity now that Merrick Garland and Lisa Monaco are pursuing aspects of this, not only the false electors, but probably other things. We talked about those already. It doesn't have to move them, but it does have to move the American public. If and when the time comes for an indictment of these top-level people, including perhaps Donald John Trump, then the American public has got to be ready to embrace that, or at a minimum, understand where it's coming from. That's the impact of what the J6 committee is doing.
Begs the question, counselor. Why Steve Bannon? Why would Trump free Steve Bannon exculpatory testimony?
Because Steve Bannon's on the hook already. Trump's trying to make it as best look for him as he possibly can.
The only person out there will say something nice about him these days.
Well, if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. But we got another half an hour. So, Jim, you better stick around, man. We're going to pull some less than nice statements out of you, because we've got a Wisconsin Supreme Court ruling that doesn't make a bit of sense, sir, at least in my opinion. But, you know, I didn't go to law school or what'd you take twice, Dom?
The LSAT.
Yeah, how'd that work out for you?
Not great.
Come back, more Devils.
I'm holding you in contempt of court.
The Devil's Advocates, radio for the 99%.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Friday edition, the happier happy hour. It's happier because we got a fine guest. He is James Santel, former U.S. attorney, our good friend and host of Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel, 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday. And if you miss it live, it also plays out again on Sunday mornings on the Shaw on Devil Radio. Jim, appreciate you coming around, man, because, you know, there's lots of legal stuff to talk about, including a couple of Wisconsin Supreme Court rulings where Hagedorn definitely flipped from the liberal side to the conservative side. But let's start with the ballot drop boxes. Apparently, they're the playthings of tyrants. And now illegal in the state of Wisconsin, apparently.
It is stunning. And to start there linguistically and from the context of the opinion, we've got a Supreme Court justice, of course, her name is Justice Bradley, and she compared the use of these drop boxes in Wisconsin to election contests that are rigged by dictators in Syria and North Korea. Full stop right there, right? I mean, is that not more of a reason to doubt the legitimacy of what she says around that? If that's the analogy you're making, no. North Korea and Syria, not even close, with all due respect, Justice Bradley. And then we can get into the analysis of what she does and does not do. But Wisconsinites should take that language in and of itself and recoil in absolute disbelief that we've got a Supreme Court justice talking that way and comparing the use of drop boxes, which have been in use for many, many years here in Wisconsin, without any showing of any election fraud, to what's going on in dictatorships in other places around the world. Stunning, shocking, regrettably, if not surprising.
Jim, let's talk about Brian Hagedorn, this supposed judicial independent. He was a Scott Walker, of course, the former Republican governor. He was a Walker attorney. He helped craft that tenet, my understanding. But on the court, he sometimes flips from the conservative side to the liberal side. But he wrote a concurrence, and he basically also said what the majority opinion wrote was bunk, but he went along with it, at least in the 4-3 ruling, which moves the court, right? Moves the ruling along. So whether it's well-founded or not, he's more than willing to go along.
That is absolutely correct. And so it's all about numbers, whether it's the United States Supreme Court or the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The side that has the most votes wins. And in this case, as you indicated, it's 4-3, including Justice Hagedorn. You're absolutely right. He has sometimes, most notably recently, in part, with respect to the redrawing of lines in Wisconsin, initially adopting what was basically the governor's plan for doing that, gets reviewed by the United States Supreme Court, comes back, and I think to surprise an awful lot of people, does almost a 180 on that and says, okay, if we've got some problems around Milwaukee, then we'll throw out the governor's maps entirely and go with the Republican plan. A very curious and, again, not discernible pattern of conduct here.
Well, Jim, and so it's also seems quite contradictory, the fact that Hagedorn also joined with the liberal bloc of the court and upheld the Dane County Public Health Authority right to issue mask mandates on an individual locality level. And that seemingly contradicts the earlier ruling of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. When the governor tried doing it, they said it's not permissible. He's a tyrant. But apparently when Dane County does it, the same justice says it's permissible. I didn't understand the splitting of the affinitive, if you will, counselor. Do you understand the difference of his opinions?
I do not, candidly, and I think a lot of people much brighter and much more astute than I am have looked at this, again, trying to identify a consistent legal pattern, a consistent theory that you can look at and say, this is how this justice works. We often have justices who are moderates, right? They're in the middle, and sometimes we'll go in different directions, but you can almost always identify a basis, a continuing stream that justifies her being slightly to the left, slightly to the right. Frankly, you can look to the many justices in the Supreme Court, even John Roberts from time to time. You can say, okay, we understand sort of where he's coming from, even if you don't always agree with him. Here, it's much more difficult to find that. And I think today's opinion falls in that category. We see a justice here who I think is troubled by what he is seeing out there and feeling out there in his home state. And yet he does throw his vote in the side of the conservatives. And as a result, today in Wisconsin, our elections are less open and they're less accessible for people to vote. The notion that we cannot have drop boxes when they're useful for what? Electricity bills, right? Utility bills, tax payments, all kinds of things out there. They're secure, they're safe. And because we have some odd specter about election fraud and voting irregularities that's completely undefined, we throw our vote in favor of invalidating them. It is very troubling. And once again, not only in the next election, whenever that should be for him, but for other justices, that should be also on the ballot, how you voted in support of ensuring that the franchise is accessible for people generally. I think that's a legitimate point of argument and questioning for Supreme Court justices as candidates and as those who are sitting on the bench.
Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, sticking around for the happy hour. Jim, thank you for doing so. Patrick Marley, formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, now making it big at the Washington Post, put a piece up on this today. We put it on our Facebook page. And he notes, as you did, that for years the ballot drop boxes were used without controversy across Wisconsin. But he points out some of these specifics in the law. Specifically that an absentee ballot, quote, must be mailed by the elector or delivered in person to the municipal clerk issuing the ballot or ballots, and also that the no person may receive a ballot from or give a ballot to a person other than the election official in charge. Now, while I am down with locked ballot boxes that were obviously expanded their use during the pandemic of up to like 500, and there's no evidence of Republican Justice Bradley indicating that this is some sort of use for totalitarian means. But if the law itself was ambiguous in some regard or not followed entirely, even though we've already done this, I mean, does this, if nothing else, provide clarity and an opportunity for future legislatures to specifically define that, hey, maybe we had a gray area here and now this is addressed and now the legislature has to do something if we want to have this privilege?
Absolutely. And so we see this all the time where courts say, you know what, the statute does not mean what you think it means and is applied in this particular way. It accomplishes maybe a result that you did not intend. So legislature, you've got to go back and change it. And we've talked about many things, including right now, for example, a fix of many, many things, Voting Rights Act, Roe versus Wade, codifications legislatively. Here, you're absolutely right to take up Patrick Marley's comment. It frankly is what Justice Bradley seizes upon. She looks at the statute itself and says, you know, returning an absentee ballot to a municipal clerk does not mean, or has been historically understood to mean, delivery to an unattended ballot drop box. And I would say, yes, the language could be more precise. Let's also understand that legislatures often assemble and we follow legislation. We know what it means. We know what their purpose is. We want to make certain that it's going to its intended target. Here, I would offer that we've got an overly lawyer-like and overly specific reading of a statute intended to ensure that the municipal clerk gets the ballots and they're not interrupted, they're not intercepted for some reason. And can you dance on the head of this pin and make this argument? Sure. And that's what the majority does, and that's what Marley's also inviting discussion about as well. I think it's a misinterpretation of the law and the intent of the law, and I think that's what the minority also advocates for.
Jim, do you think it will have any impact on Wisconsin elections in a significant way? I mean, it was a trend during the pandemic, but there's less impetus to have to absentee ballot vote or to not be able to at least drop it off at the clerk's office.
Sure. And again, that's the impact of having discussions like this, right? We're focusing on what the Supreme Court has done. And so the word is now, you don't rely upon on those boxes that are out there. I assume they're going to be closed down anyway. And it may not have a dramatic impact because, again, post-academic and post-pandemic, as you just indicated, Mike, people will understand if you want to vote, you got to get that ballot to its proper location. It's part of its education, too. Do not anticipate this ease of voting. It's just a small, but nonetheless, I would say, important hurdle that people putting up to the exercising the franchise in our state.
Well, it's certainly consistent with the voter suppression activities of Republicans these days. Jim, I have a very specific question. I voted absentee early vote, and I went to drop off my ballot at the vestibule between the outer door and the inner door of my Whitefish Bay City Hall / Police Department. And in that building, and perhaps very nearby, are the election officials. I go in the basement when I vote in person normally. What happens in that circumstance? I mean, how close does a person have to be to the box? And is that now going to be illegal, even though it's in a very seemingly secure, camered area?
Right. Probably the next lawsuits, right? Is Dominic's vote, is yours going to count? And bringing that lawsuit on behalf of yourself and others who are similarly situated, challenging a decision. You know, there's a situation where, once again, you rely on public servants, whether it's police officers or election clerks or people in the city hall there in Whitefish Bay to say, okay, what is this? This is a ballot. There's no reason to believe it's in any way compromised. Let's get it to that right spot. Plainly, now we know as of this morning that the drop boxes are no longer a proper way to doing that. You know that. I know that. We all know that. But we still rely upon people to focus on ensuring that ballots get to where they should be. Interestingly, the Supreme Court today did not address this other so-called ballot return assistance issue, did not touch that, which is interesting. Obviously, the other side wanted them to discredit and disqualify ballots that are, in a very inappropriate term, it's called harvesting. They didn't touch that at all, which, again, is curious and interesting, but probably a good thing. Kind of goes to your example. If you need to ensure that a ballot gets to where it should be without any real indication of fraud, that should not be a problem. And it hasn't been a problem in recent past elections.
Jim, President Joe Biden came out today and he signed an executive order and he tried to effectively reassure the American people that there are ways to codify Roe v. Wade. And he suggested go vote, go elect a couple of more Democratic senators as a remedy, hold on to the House. But in terms of executive fiat, signing an executive order, Jim, it was a tip of the cap to the base. It said, hey, I'm fighting for you. But it was something of a feckless effort, no doubt, sir. Or am I wrong, Jim?
No, I think that's right. When you look at the things that are the summaries of what the president did, again, commendations to him for making this effort to send this message to the President of the United States of America, the executive of the White House, speaks about the Supreme Court's decision as being catastrophic for the country. That's no small thing. The executive order is not a small thing either, but it doesn't change the reality, provides some funding perhaps to states that are looking for ways of addressing this issue. It does a few other things around the edges, but doesn't attack the principal issue, which is that the Supreme Court has found that there is no constitutionally vested right to privacy when it comes to reproductive rights, which is huge. And for that, you either need a new Supreme Court reinterpreting the Constitution as it has been since January 22nd of 1973, or you need a federal legislature that's going to codify Roe versus Wade in the House and the Senate. Joe Biden would sign that also. Or then you need to get back into the states and find more than 25, more than half of the states who are going to go in the opposite direction. That last option is not going to happen, not in this present climate. So he's doing what he can. It is not going to change the dynamics a whole lot, but I don't mean to minimize it either.
Jim Santel, probably call it a day, man. I know you got a big show tomorrow morning, 9 to 11, Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. But the Wisconsin Supreme Court race next spring, the balance of the court could be at stake. Jim, how big a deal do you think next spring's election is?
It is. Anytime we elect a Supreme Court justice, anytime we appoint a Supreme Court justice, judges generally, it's a big deal. They adjudicate small things we never hear about, contests between private parties that we are not in the docket. But they also address, as we saw today and in other times, big issues. And so who is on that court? 7 people. It's not a lot of human beings. This is not 435 people in the Congress. It's 7 people. Every single one of them counts. Every vote in Wisconsin counts as well.
Jim, when are you announcing your candidacy, sir? We got your back, Jim.
I've got a big show tomorrow to do on the wrap-up on Supreme Court cases, and that's what my focus is on tonight.
Occupy didn't start on Wall Street. It started on our street, the Devil's Advocates.
And we are back. Thank you for listening to the Devil's Advocates radio show, the last segment of the day, of the week. If you got something to say, you haven't aired your grievances yet, give us a call at 844-967-2789.
Dominic, got to thank the incomparable James Santel, former U.S. attorney. He is the host of Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel, Saturday mornings 9 to 11, recorded live at the Shaw Studios, downtown Waukesha. It plays out on Devil Radio. And then if you miss it, no excuses. But if you miss it, it replays on Sunday mornings between 9 and 11. No excuses. Just listen. So anyways.
Thank you, Jim. That's always great. Going on. You know, this is how the news cycle works. We initially, we'd been texting with Jim all week, and on Wednesday it came out that the IRS was investigating Comey and McCabe from the FBI, and I was kind of like, well, let's talk about it, counselor. And then like 2 days later, all this other stuff happens, and we never even got to that very specific topic. So let me just bring it up briefly as one of my grievances. The New York Times, the IRS said on Thursday that its commissioner, Charles P. Redding, has asked the inspector general who oversees tax matters to investigate how James Comey, the former FBI director, and his deputy, Andrew McCabe, both perceived enemies of the former president, came to be faced with a rare, exhaustive audit that the agency says are supposed to be random. A quote, the IRS has referred the matter to the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration for review, and he said that he personally reached out to the Inspector General's office after learning of the audits.
Well, are you satisfied? You got your last grievance. Can I have one last grievance?
Well, certainly.
Well, here it is, Dom, from Newsweek. A Milwaukee restaurant owner allegedly threatened to dangle his workers from a tall building after the kitchen staff walked off the job.
Well, I can't imagine why they would leave such a hospitable working environment. You know, it's the old, the beatings will continue until morale improves management style.
Well, Dominic, a viral post in the Reddit forum Anti-Work on Tuesday claimed that Bob Weiss, owner of Shaker Cigar Bar in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, sent a raging email to employees after they walked out on April 22nd. Reddit user, u/butt_bunch, amassed over 25,000 votes on a photo of Weiss's email. Before the post went viral, other users shared the same screenshot on different forums and similarly attributed it to Weiss. But let's get to the heart of the matter, Dom, the email. The email read, "Dear staff of Friday, April 22nd, after the escapades of Friday night,
woohoo!
We have lost a chef and a food program. I hope you are happy with how you treated my business." There's more. Weiss claimed that after the walkout, Shakers was left a shadow of what was one of the most prominent venues in the Midwest, with a hard-earned reputation for extraordinary food beyond what your shallow minds will accept. Beyond what your shallow minds will accept, and which has been in existence for almost 4 decades, certainly before any of you were alive. I've been doing this since before you were alive. A little bit more here. The lamentation escalated to a threat as he continued. Anyone who needs a lesson in how we treated this in Vietnam, I have the balls to look me up.
What? So when the chef quit in Vietnam, you, dangled people over tall buildings or just shot them?
I'm not exactly sure.
It's kind of a...
when we were at the presidential debate, the first one in 2016, it was like Bernie and O'Malley and that Jim Webb guy, the guy that killed a man in Vietnam.
Right.
In closing, Weiss said, "You should not be surprised if my Serbian or Cuban collection agents do not find you anytime, anywhere in the next year and dangle you from a tall building. You've cost the business and you deserve to pay the price, and you shall pay the price."
Wow, man.
Now, staff resignations at Shaker Cigar Bar were also mentioned in a Google review of the restaurant. Pretty awful ownership that has caused quite a few issues, especially with customer service.
What?
Had chef walked out for good reason, would be sad to see this place go, but happy as a bee to see the ownership get tossed and better ownership take its place. A response from the owner took a similar tone to the email circulating.
He responded.
Oh, yeah. Of course he does. Do not respond to social media trolling, sir. Just a little recommendation from, you know, a couple of guys that have been trolled once or twice on the social medias. Here's what he said. "Our over 35 years says much for the quality of our operation," Weiss replied to the review. "Perhaps you should know the facts before you recite internet pablum cancel culture."
Oh, he just laid it all out right there for you.
Cancel,
we got a Trumpster.
Culture,
we got a Trumpster.
Now, Dom, food service workers quit their jobs at a rate of 5.6% in April, nearly twice the national average of 2.9%, according to the BLS. And in 2021, a survey by JobList, restaurant staff cited low pay as the leading motivation to join the Great Resignation. The other most common reasons were their desire for a new career, a lack of benefits, difficult customers, and maybe bosses, and long hours and rigid schedules and potential exposure to COVID-19. How do you think this Weiss dude, I mean, I don't know, but how do you think his attitude was during the pandemic to the whole masking and the
not a lot of masking,
forced closing?
Probably not. Reddit users, Crudy, were stunned, I tell you, by Weiss's threats brazenly put in writing to his employees. One reader, pardon me, commented, "That's a long-winded way to say, I'm so garbage at management, my staff walked out, and I'm incapable of taking any responsibility, so I'm blaming you and threatening your life." Another wrote dryly, "Threatening your old staff with extortion. Man, that's great to post publicly about. Now, if anything happens to any of them, the police are making him numero uno." Newsweek reached out to Shaker's Cigar Bar for comment. Apparently, he has not commented back to the Newsweeks. And I would just say, okay, the cancel culture is kind of a tell. Yeah, the cancel culture comment, kind of a tell. The maskless pictures on the Facebook pages that I saw, perhaps a little tell. But I would just say this. I can certainly understand, you know, if you own a business and your employees, you know, decided to, you know, close down by partying until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning one night, and your chef decided, you know, I've had enough of this and I'm out. I can get the angst that causes. But to threaten your employees by dangling them, and I guess maybe by the ankles so the change drops out like a bully taking your lunch money, but I wasn't clear that wasn't a hanging over the side of the building. Very inappropriate, sir. I will not be attending the cigar bar.
I got to tell you, Dom, from my own personal management style and my own personal experience, dangling people from tall buildings, not as easy as you'd think.
Yeah.
It's really quite difficult.
Well, it takes a lot of upper body strength and leverage.
Leverage helps.
Unless you use a rope. You know what I mean?
It sort of gives you a little leverage, if you know what I'm saying. thank you to our fine guest, James Santel. Stick around, at least if you're in Madison, for Dana Fruits Radio and In Pursuit of Sunshine on the radio. And don't forget, Morning Cannolis with James Santel, 9 to 11, right here on Devil Radio and The Shaw. Have a great weekend. See you next week. Be safe.
See you at Summerfest, everybody.